This talk was given by Prabhu Gikan Vasan at the Zen Center of New York City. Gikan is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about the temple's retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org/ccnyc. Thanks for listening.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Gikan, and I was asked to offer the talk today. First, I just wanted to say welcome to everyone who's here for the first time. We had a wonderful group of beginning instruction, some great questions you guys were asking, so right on. Thank you. Also, just want to say, as always, it just is wonderful to be here. I don't live in the city anymore, but almost all of my training in Zen was done here. And every time I come here, I just feel just a real sense of gratitude to all of you who keep this place running and humming every day. So thank you, everyone. I want to look at a passage, a teaching from the Mahanama Sutra from the Pali Canon. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the sutra, but I just want to start by reading the passage. You should remember the Buddha, the supreme guide for those who wish to practice. You should remember the Dharma, visible here and now, inviting verification so people can know it for themselves. You should remember the Sangha, those who practice what's good and straightforward, the incomparable field of merit for the world. You should remember your own virtues, unbroken, unstained, liberating, praiseworthy. You should remember your own generosity, among those with stained and stingy hearts, being open-handed, magnanimous, responsive, delighting in giving. And you should remember the gods and devas, whose faith, virtue, practice, and generosity led to good rebirth, and say with conviction, I too have the same faith, virtue, practice, and generosity. So, we are coming upon the final week of our fall Ango, our 3-month intensive practice period. If you're anything like me, you are either really deep and grounded in it, or you're like, you know, oh shit, what happened to the last 3 months? Or, you know, maybe somewhere in between. For those of us who are new, spring and fall are periods of intensive and intentional spiritual practice here. Those of us who choose to participate, we make commitments to engage the various areas of spiritual training that we do here. And there are, you know, renewal of vows ceremonies that are offered during Ango. There are academic study sessions, question and answer sessions with the teachers, you know, all to sort of inspire and challenge us during these periods of intensive practice. And Ango really goes back to the very beginnings of Buddhism. As many of us know, the Buddha and his monks were wandering monastics. They didn't form roots anywhere. But twice a year, during the rainy seasons in India, because of the rains, they weren't able to wander. The roads were impassable. So they actually had to gather together. And they would erect a temporary shelter, and they would practice together. These were times of really rich and fruitful communal practice. It was a time where junior students could ask questions of the Buddha or senior students. Dialogues happened, and in fact, the Buddha gave teachings during these rainy seasons that have really become key and integral parts of our of the canon of sutras. So the Mahanama Sutra. When I was kind of reading around for something to present today, I was really happy to find this because it is just like almost relevant, almost like an uncanny degree to like us here on this particular Sunday. You know, first, it was one of these rainy season teachings. The sutra begins by saying that the Buddha was spending the rainy season in the city of Kapalavatsu, which was his birthplace. He went back there for this particular rainy season. So this teaching, it happens during Ango, right? It happened during that period of communal practice. And even more precisely for right now, it actually takes place as Ango is coming to a close. There's a wonderful little detail at the beginning of the sutra where Mahanama was observing that some of the monks were sewing a new robe for the Buddha. And he understood from that the rainy seasons were coming to an end soon. And when they did, the Buddha would put on that new robe and would leave to resume wandering. You know, isn't that just a lovely detail? It's just a real window into just the student-teacher relationship and how they practiced back then. I was trying to think of the equivalent that we could do, and maybe when Shugan goes to New Zealand every year, we could make him like a pecan pie or lemon bars or something. I don't know, something like that, right? It was nice. So 2.5 millennia ago, Ango was coming to an end in the city of Kapalavatsu. Mahanama was a resident of the city, and he was a lay practitioner, what they called a householder. And he actually had several dialogues with the Buddha. And the questions he asked, I found that, you know, once I cut through the formalities of the way the language of the sutras work, the questions he asked were actually very familiar. You know, he asked the Buddha on one occasion how to counsel fellow students who are sick and dying. On another occasion, he actually asked what would happen to him if he should meet with a bad end in the city. He actually says, you know, Kapalavatsu is crowded and populous and congested. It's pretty much why I left New York City, FYI. And he said, you know, sometimes when I'm in the city, I meet up with a rampaging elephant, a rampaging chariot, or a rampaging person. At those times, my mind gets muddled, and I wonder, if I died right now, what would be my course? Right. He asked the Buddha, what are the qualities of a good student? He asked, how can he tell if his practice is self-centered, right? Is overly self-centered, you know? So like many of us, Mahanama was a lay student. He worked and lived in a big urban environment, and he felt the pressures of that. And periodically, he would go to his teacher for face-to-face teaching, right, for guidance. In this particular dialogue, you know, Mahanama realized that soon the rainy season would be over, the Buddha would put on his new robe, and would leave with his monks to resume wandering. I actually just saw that a woman who was here for the first time just left the zendo and went upstairs. Could someone please go to check if she's doing okay? Thank you. And so he went to the Buddha, and he asked for guidance. And it's interesting, you know, in one translation, the question he asks is, for those of us, well, first off, he starts by presenting the situation. He starts by saying, I understand that soon you're going to be leaving. And in one translation, he then asks, for those of us living by means of various dwelling places, by means of which dwelling place should we live? In another translation, he says, for those like us whose minds dwell here and there, where should we place our minds? So it's a curious way of phrasing the question. My read on this is, you know, being a layperson, right, being a householder, he realized that he wouldn't be able to practice in the way the Buddha and his monks were practicing, right? He couldn't just up and leave. He had commitments, right? And I want to pause there because I found that was kind of poignant. You know, I remember when I used to practice here, and I practiced here for a long time, you know, every week, you know, a teacher or a monastic would come down from the monastery, guide us for a few days, maybe offer a retreat, offer the Sunday talk, and then they'd go, right? And, you know, it's interesting that, you know, they sort of, you know, they came into this cloister, and then they left into the cloister of the monastery, and that's not our life. That wasn't my life. Right. And so I sort of just kind of, when I was reading this, you know, it was interesting. I sort of realized that, yeah, you know, that was something that I would feel. I wouldn't quite put it into words, but, you know, I realized that I couldn't practice in that way, you know. Now maybe some of you also feel the same if you come here for a while. And so he went to the Buddha and he asked his question, and the Buddha, being his teacher, offered instruction. You should remember the Buddha, supreme guide for those who wish to practice. You should remember the Dharma, visible here and now, inviting verification so people can know it for themselves. You should remember the Sangha, those who practice what's good and straightforward, the incomparable field of merit for the world. So Mahanama's question was, where should I dwell? And the Buddha's first response was, don't dwell by yourself. Right? I think some of us might recognize the wording of that first part is very similar to what we say when we take refuge in the three treasures. Right? I take refuge in the Buddha, the world-honored one. I take refuge in the Dharma, honorable for its purity. I take refuge in the Sangha, honorable for its harmony. Taking refuge has always been the way to enter practice. Whether that happens formally or whether that happens implicitly by, say, coming here on a Sunday for beginning instruction, right? Coming here, walking down the street, and then turning away from the street and turning into this place, right? Because I think for most of us, whether we can put it into words or not, there's some maybe inkling that what this has to offer, this place, is different than what we're finding out there. Right? Essentially, it's a recognition that we can't do this on our own. Right? We need help and we need support. In some ways, you know, that's easy to verify, right? All we have to do is to think of what our mind does when we're listening to, say, a teacher lead an academic study session versus what it does when, you know, we're at a staff meeting at work. Right? What we do with our minds when we're in orioki, right? The formal meal that we have during our meditation retreats versus when we're having lunch at our desk. Right? You know, what we do when we're doing kinhin versus what we do when we're, you know, in a train station, right? Something different has to happen. Ryushin Sensei, who was a teacher here, once remarked that taking refuge is like falling out of a boat and washing up on an island. Everything you need to live has to come from that island. Right? There's nothing else to turn to. There's nowhere else to go. And Hogen Sensei, and this is going way back, way before he was a sensei, he was still a monastic at that time, he once remarked that if we really take refuge in the three treasures, everything that we need to live will be given to us. It might not be what we were expecting we need. It might not be what we think we deserve. It might not be what we think we're entitled to. But if we put ourselves into the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we will get everything that we need to live our lives according to the Buddha, Dharma. Right? So all of that, the Buddha's teaching, Ryushin's teaching, Hogen's teaching, those were, I see them as real, just complete expressions of taking refuge, right? And, you know, but how do we do this, right? We, us, you know, lay practitioners, right? How do we do this in the midst of our busy lives, right? When we're, most of the time, we're not in a cloister, right? We're in the midst of rampaging elephants, rampaging thoughts, right? How do we do this, right? I think it's important to start where we can. Right? And that's not in big ways. In most of the time, it's in very, very small ways, right? I think many of us have a little altar at work, maybe, right? Very simple, right? Because why is that important? You know, why is it important that every time, like, for those of you who've been to the monastery for a week-long meditation retreat, I think you sort of know this, where, you know, you finished your work assignment, you know, and you're like, you've got like 5 minutes, you know, you like strip out of your work clothes, strip onto your robe, slam down a cup of coffee, bolt up the stairs into the zendo, and then what happens? You stop and you bow, right? You know, you're completely frenetic, right? Because the period's about to start, maybe the jikido's already hit the bell like once, and you're like, damn, I gotta go, and then we stop and we bow. We bow at the threshold, right? Something happens. Right? Something happens to our mind, right? Because we're entering a space and there's a Buddha up on that altar, right? Having an altar at work, I found, works sometimes in the same way. As long as I remember that there's an altar at work, right? I once, when I had my own office, I have this practice where I would just bow. Every time I had to leave my office and came back in, when I make contact, I would just bow. Right? Or, you know, when I didn't have my own office, I didn't do that, but I did other stuff, right? Maybe at the beginning, when I got into work, I would just open up my little water bottle and offer a drop of water in front of the altar. Maybe say a couple lines of liturgy, right? That is, I remember the Buddha, right? I think many of us maybe do the same thing. We can remember the Dharma, right? By taking a line of teaching that speaks to us and carrying it with us. I remember when I first began to practice, you know, we chant the Heart Sutra every single Sunday, right? And so I knew it was important and I had no idea what it was talking about. Like zip. You know, I memorized it and I still had no idea what it was talking about. But one line stood out, right? No gain, and thus the bodhisattva lives prajnaparamita with no hindrance in the mind. No hindrance, therefore no fear. I shortened it to no gain, and thus no hindrance in the mind, therefore no fear. I got that, right? Because at that time, and still, I had fear. Anxiety, turmoil, sometimes inner, sometimes situational. Okay, so that's something that spoke to me. I can carry this and use this. And I did. You know, when I remembered, when I was in a situation, if I remembered, I'd call up that line. And the first thing I identified was the fear. That was the one that was most sort of present to me. Okay, got it. All right. Let's trace this backwards. What's the hindrance in the mind? What is the thought that's in my mind that's leading to the fear? And then what's the gain that's fueling that thought? And over time, I understood that gain was essentially anything that I wanted to be different than what was exactly happening at that moment. Right? Was it the complete depth of the Heart Sutra? No. Right? But that was okay. You know, because I had faith that if this was a true teaching, it would have to apply in that situation, no matter how mundane that situation was. And this was a way for me to start. So we start small. And I think we start small and we continue small. Right? It's never gotten big for me. It's always small. But that's okay. Right? And in small ways, we bring ourselves, our words, our thoughts, and actions into accord with the teachings by degrees. Most of the time messing up, but by degrees. You should remember your own virtues. Unbroken, unstained, liberating, praiseworthy. You should remember your own generosity. Among those with stained and stingy hearts, being open-hearted, open-handed, magnanimous, responsive, delighting in giving. So having brought up the three treasures, having brought up what we absolutely need to depend on, the Buddha brought up the other side of it. Your own virtues, your own generosity, right? You know, Daito Roshi used to say, we can't do this ourselves, but no one else can do this for us. Right? And in some ways, you know, my understanding of these two lines is, the Buddha really brought up something even more basic than the three treasures. Right? Because it's a fundamental teaching in Buddhism that our goodness isn't dependent on Buddhism. It's not dependent on practicing here. It's not dependent on the three treasures. It's inherent. Right? It's something that we have and we've always possessed, regardless before we even walked in through this door. And in fact, it's something we possess even when we're not practicing that way in our lives. So when do we need to remember our virtues and generosity? It's when we're not practicing them. Right? When we forget the best parts of ourselves, that's when we need to remember the best parts of ourselves. In one of the commentaries we're reading this Ango, Bhikkhu Bodhi, contemporary teacher, says, the same energy fuels desire, aggression, and violence on the one hand, and generosity, self-discipline, and kindness on the other. I think that's really key. Okay? Because what it means is that when we are fueling the worst parts of ourselves, and we all do, at that very moment, we have that exact energy we need to fuel the best parts of ourselves. And it can happen in the moment. You know, I would see this when I used to practice as a clinical social worker. I would see this all the time when I was working with couples or with a parent and a child. Like, there's something that was just locked in just like the most deepest shit in my therapy session. And suddenly oftentimes the parent would just be like, okay, you know, eyes closed, almost always took a deep breath, and there's like, and I would sort of recognize that I needed to sort of open that moment up, and I'd say, what just happened? And inevitably, they would say, we're doing it again. We're doing what we always do, right? And we can't continue. Some version of, we have to do it differently, right? Those are really important moments, because in that moment, they remembered. Well, first, they saw clearly what they've been doing again and again and again. And they remembered that they can do it differently and they have to do it differently. Right? Almost none of them practice Buddhism, right? But they still were able to do that because Buddhism doesn't own that, right? It's a capacity we all have. And it's important to do that, right? It's important, I guess the best way to say it is, you know, it's important that we are the worst that we can be, so that we can then see that and be the best that we can be. And that process is absolutely crucial. You know, I was watching a video on accountability. The Barnard Center for Research on Women has a great series of videos on accountability where they actually talk about work that they're doing with perpetrators of harm, sometimes serious harm. They're doing, you know, outside the criminal justice system. They really are trying to work with accountability in a different way. And one of these speakers said, as like a frame for why they do this, who can move in close to the person who has caused harm? Probably not the survivor, right? But there's someone who can. Right? That's why they work with this. And I think, you know, this is a beautiful expression of what I'm talking about, because it really shows that, you know, when we can transform the poison inside, we can approach the poison outside. Right? Because we know that, number one, it can be transformed, and two, that's not all that person is, because that's not all we were. Right? If it was, we could never have transformed it, but we did. So now we can see that in other people. The contemporary African-American teacher, Angel Kyuto Williams, just had a fantastic interview with Krista Tippett in On Being. And in one of those things, she really talks about the need to have a deep and abiding, she's talking about racism. And she said there's the need to have a deep and abiding sense that there are human beings at the other end of that baton, that stick, that policy, that are also trapped. Again, a real expression that, you know, having really worked on herself, her own poisons, she's now able to see that even in very, very difficult circumstances, she's able to see that she's able to see the Four Noble Truths, the suffering that is present in someone who really wants to cause her harm. Right? That's almost like a beautiful expression of how these two lines work. What happens when we remember who we really are, right? The best parts of ourselves. And you should remember the gods and devas whose faith, virtue, practice, and generosity led to good rebirth. And say with conviction, I too have the same faith, virtue, practice, and generosity. I will admit I had a hard time with this one. Gods and devas. I was with them for the first five. You know, Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, yep, got it. You know, my own virtue, my generosity, yep, on it. You know, I'm there, right? I'm good with this. Gods and devas, I was like, well, when? What's going on here, right? This is weird, all right? So let me just tell you how I'm working with this. As lay folk, I think one of the most important things we have to guard against is becoming discouraged in our practice, becoming dejected. I think that's maybe particularly acute for lay practitioners because we're outside the cloister all the time, right? Oftentimes it's just us trying to, you know, dig in deep, right? Into meeting, bringing practice into our lives. And if you're like me, most of the time messing up, right? It's easy to get discouraged. There's a wonderful dialogue between Mahanama and the Buddha that really addresses this. Mahanama approaches the Buddha and says, I have long understood that greed, hate, and ignorance defile the mind. Yet there are still times when greed invades my mind, when hatred, when ignorance invade my mind. What remains unabandoned within me so that greed, hate, and ignorance invade my mind? Okay, I found this very moving, right? Because he's really making himself vulnerable here, right? And in some ways, you know, as I thought about this, I realized that, you know, just about everything that I brought to my teacher, right, in my, like, whatever, 18, 19, 20 years of practice has been a variation on this, right? I know what the teachings say. I believe them. And yet I act in ways contrary to it. Okay. Why does this keep happening? What's wrong with me? That's essentially what he's bringing in. And the Buddha's answer, the Buddha first starts, and I'm paraphrasing here, but the Buddha first starts by affirming his practice. He says, yes, you have clearly and accurately seen that the three poisons lead to stress and despair, right? Which is something that my teacher has always done. Every time I'm thinking my practice is shit, you know, he's always said, no, you're not doing anything wrong. Your practice is fine. But then the Buddha goes on. He says, but you haven't yet attained joy and pleasure apart from these unskillful states of mind. Therefore, you can still be tempted by them. And he goes on to basically say, when you've attained joy and pleasure apart from the poisons, you won't be tempted by the poisons. So essentially, you know, the Buddha is telling Mahanama, your practice is fine, and you still have to practice. You still have to practice. And that's just the way it is, right? He doesn't try to justify this. He just says, this is the case. So, you know, gods and devas whose, you know, faith, whose practice is so strong that it gives them, leads to great rebirth. You know, we all know them, right? I'm sure we all have models of people in mind whose practice is so strong that, you know, whether it's rebirth in the next life or rebirth into this life, they're able to move through this world in a way that's good, right? We have models of this. They got nothing that we don't have. Right? Say with conviction, right? Whatever quality they've cultivated, whatever quality they've developed in order to move through the world that way, we have those same qualities. There is nothing special about them. When the Buddha attained enlightenment, you know, he said, at this moment, I, the great earth, and all creatures attain the way at once. This was partially a recognition of that, right? He recognized that there was nothing special about him after so many years of trying to cultivate, of cultivating, of developing and trying a path, discarding that path, trying another path, finding a path, practicing that path. He realized that he wasn't special. We all have this. And I think for lay practitioners, it's very important to keep this in mind because it's very easy to fall into this pit of thinking, I can't do this. And then the reasons why you can't do this will just follow, right? They're just lining up, ready to just, you know, start just developing, right? So very important to keep this in mind, this conviction that he's talking about here. So, I want to end by talking about this refrain, you should remember. You should remember, you should remember, you should remember. This is what the Buddha offered Mahanama, right? It was nothing new. He's saying, no, you got this. You just got to remember this, right? The reason, of course, the Buddha says you should remember so much is because we forget, right? You know, there's a moment that I always thought was very striking in the life of the Buddha when he almost forgot, right? It would happen shortly just after he attained enlightenment. You know, he had attained enlightenment at the Bodhi seat. And then he found himself, though, really having ambivalence about teaching. Some of us know the story. You know, he sort of cast his mind over the world and he realized that there were people he called it, cloaked in the mass of darkness, that they wouldn't get his teaching. But essentially what he was saying was, the world is, there's too much suffering in the world. Right? So, you know, he said, and he teetered. He teetered between entering that suffering and staying within the peace that he had found. Right? And so Brahma, up in the heavens, saw this was happening and exclaimed, the world is lost. The world is destroyed. The mind of the Buddha inclines to dwelling at ease, not to teaching the Dharma. And he came down and he beseeched the Buddha to teach, and the Buddha was convinced. That's us. I just want to start by saying that. Okay, whenever any of us look at the world and say, it's too much, you know, I can't enter it, the world is lost. The world is destroyed. Okay. But the Buddha had it easy, right? He had Brahma coming down to like steer him back. And I was thinking, wouldn't it be great if we had that? Like every time we were going to mess up, if someone ran in there and like grabbed our shoulders, like, hey, what's going on? Like, what are you thinking? You know, like the world is dead if you do this, right? It would be great, right? But we're not that fortunate. You know, if we think about it, the only thing we have when we begin to turn away is remembering, right? When we forget, the only thing we have is to remember, right? So it's important to cultivate that capacity to remember the teachings. Right. And it's an active cultivation. I remember when I first moved to the city way back, I took a course. There's a place called the Open Center. It's like a spiritual center. I took a course in Buddhism with Robert Thurman, who's a contemporary teacher. And at one point, you know, he was talking about compassion. And he said, it's really important to recall that in this Buddhist cosmology of rebirth, that we've all been each other's mothers, fathers, caregivers. We've all been each other's children. We've all been each other's friends and guardians in order to cultivate compassion. And someone in the audience raised their hand and said, yeah, but therefore, isn't it also true that we've all been each other's enemies? We've all been each other's torturers, each other's tormentors, each other's oppressors. Isn't that also equally true? And Thurman said, yes, but that's not what we need to recall. Yeah. And he said, you know, given the amount of conflict in the world, that's the one thing we don't need. We know that already. We know how to be each other's enemies. Right? What we need to recall is the other part of this. Right? So memory doesn't just happen. Well, it just happens, but the way the Buddha is framing this is that it's an active practice, right? There are ways we can use remembering to cultivate our practice, and there are ways that we can use remembering to keep us mired in what we know already just hasn't worked for us. So, Ango is ending. Our rainy season is coming to a close. Fortunately, our teachers will not be wandering, at least as far as I know. Maybe Shugen has a road trip plan that he hasn't told us about yet, but presumably they won't be wandering. But, you know, as we move out of the container of Ango, or if this is your first time here, as you move out of this container, out into the world, let's remember to remember. Okay? Let's not forget. Let's, when we find ourselves in difficult situations in our environment, right? In our rampaging world. Let's remember who we are, and in the biggest and the most intimate sense of what that means. And let's remember who we are to each other in the biggest and the most intimate sense of what that means. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.